Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today is James Vogel, a former backgammon and poker player, hedge fund operator, and numerous other things from the London area. We'll be talking to James in a few minutes. It is getting close to the time that we have another Bob Nersessian show, so we are inviting our listeners to send in more Bob Nersessian questions. You can send them as an email to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com, or by the time you hear this, Richard will have a whole post area on gamblingwithanedge.com where you can enter them directly there. All right, let's talk to our guest. James Vogel played backgammon for a number of years, poker for a number of years, quit it to go get a day job. And so we're going to be talking to him. James Vogel, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Hi, guys. Thanks for having me.
Tell us about your backgammon career.
Well, I first played backgammon what my grandfather taught me when I was about six. And just by chance, I had a board at my tennis club because I was sort of a semi-pro tennis player just before college. And there was one tennis player, older guy at the club, and he loved to play, and we played, and I ended up winning probably 99 out of 100 sessions, and it was quite nice pocket money. But I always sort of beat my friends because my grandfather taught me the fundamentals, but I never played against any good players. And one year, there was the Times Mindsport Olympics were being held in London, and my father saw the advert. He said, "You fancy yourself as a backgammon player?" So I went along to the tournament and didn't really know all the tournament rules, like the Crawford rule, etc. But managed to come third for a bronze. And all the guys there playing asked me to come down to the club and play for money. And I thought they were trying to hustle me, but I went along and had a look and started playing for pretty low stakes in a charrette and winning, and just every few months building up and playing in bigger and bigger games and then traveling to tournaments. So I guess that was my introduction to gambling.
Is there still an active backgammon club in London?
No, the scene's pretty dead. I think that there's one pub where they play a 10 or 20 pound charrette a couple of times a week, but that's about it.
20 pound charrette sounds like a significant game to me.
Well, it did to me when I was about 19, but it's not sort of, it's, you know, there's four or five players, and I guess the swings, the 20 pound charrette, you know, it's not going to be much bigger than 50 point swing on a night. It's £1,000, you know, 13, yeah. 14, 15, yeah,
Bob's,
it's not the biggest game.
Bob's
yes.
frame of reference, you have to realize, is 30 years old, so.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they were playing for the stakes back in the 70s, or much higher.
Right.
There's been a bit of inflation or deflation in the backgammon world.
Maybe they were. I wasn't. Although I used to play quarter video poker, and now that doesn't strike me as a good game at all. All right, so you dropped out of backgammon near the turn of the century and started playing poker. How did that go?
Yeah, I never really dropped out of backgammon. I kept playing, but the problem was the liquidity wasn't there. People didn't want to gamble high enough, and you know, you weren't always paid when you won. There was a big problem with knocking in the backgammon world. And I was playing a tournament in London. I think it was probably around 2000, maybe 2001. And Gus Hansen, he was called Gus Jacobson back then. Was playing in this tournament. We both got knocked out, and he said, "I'm going to play poker at the casino. Do you want to come and watch?" And I never played, I'd heard of poker, obviously, but I'd never played before. I went to sit and watch Kibitz him, and he was playing in the biggest game in London, and I don't know if you've heard of Devilfish, but he was a pretty big character in the British poker scene.
That Mr. Oliot!
Yeah, Mr. Oliot, yeah. Dave the Fish. And he was playing at the same game as Gus, and everyone had, I don't know, 5,000 to 10,000 pounds in front of them, and it was very appealing and it was exciting and the banter was good. And again, I just started playing in the small game in that casino, which was pretty close to my house, and grinding away and learning maybe the first year breaking even and then starting to win. And it was before the days of online poker really. Online poker was only just starting a few years after that. I wasn't a natural talent in poker, but sort of worked at it pretty hard and read all the literature that's out there and put in a lot of hours at the game, at the table, and improved a bit. And went on to play some tournaments and do okay in some tournaments, and was lucky enough to win the first World Series event I ever played at 23. So that was my introduction to poker, really.
And what event was that?
It was the first event's always the event for the dealers, but it was the first open event of the 2004 World Series. It was a $2,000 hold'em tournament with about just over 800 players, I think, back then. It was the first event after Moneymaker had won the previous year. So it was the first event, the first year where poker really started to take off. It was exciting time to be playing.
Yes, certainly. Were there any books that stood out above the others to you in regard to poker?
Trying to think. Obviously, I probably started with the Theory of Poker by Sklansky, which is probably a bit dated now. And you know, he uses things like you've got to raise to find out where you're at, and that's not part of the modern game. I enjoyed a really old book, which is now out of print, called Play Poker, Quit Work, and Sleep Till Noon. I don't know if you ever heard of that one, but yeah, that's right. Yeah, I found it. It was out of print edition in the Gambler's Bookstore in Vegas one year, and I just love, you know, there's a chapter, how do you assess an opponent when you're sitting at a table with players for the first time? And there was a whole chapter on judging someone by their watch. So if someone was wearing a really expensive Rolex in a tiny game, they were probably just a recreational player and you couldn't bluff them. But if someone was wearing a digital watch, playing in the biggest game, they were no doubt pretty tight. So I kind of enjoyed that one, which wasn't, standard poker theory, but I probably learned more from that one than most books.
I'm still wondering why Gus Hansen changed his name. Did he get married or something?
I think it was probably to do with tax reasons. Back in the day when he started playing poker, big stakes, and you know, Denmark have a pretty punitive taxation law for professional gamblers. So I think it's probably something to do with that. I'm speculating. I'm not exact. I can't remember why.
Did he Did he do any mentoring for you in poker? Or
no, we weren't really that close. You know, I sort of saw him around all the backgrounds tournaments, but he's not a good friend of mine. But you know, we talked over some hands, and I obviously read his book, and you know, he was quite. You know, people have mixed feelings about Gus. You know, because he's lost so much money playing online poker in recent years, but you know, he's just a brilliant all-around games player and thinker about games. And at the time, when he was winning all those World Poker Tour tournaments, when they just started, you know, he was playing a different form of poker to everyone else. He was playing hands that no one else would play. You know, I think I watched him raise like 18 consecutive hands and no one re-raised him. So, you know, he was just a different style of poker when everyone else was so tight. So it was good watching him. But, you know, he was friends with most of the Scandinavian guys who were, you know, there were so many great backgammon players, Scandinavian guys that went on to do amazingly well at either poker or sports betting in recent years.
So how long did you play poker before you decided you wanted to go out and get a real job? Not that poker.
I never really wanted a real job, but I started playing poker probably around 2000, and after I won that tournament in Vegas, that was pretty much, I maybe played for another 6 months after that. And that was a springboard. I sort of used that to help me get a job in finance, by accident, really.
Did you, once the online started, were you playing a lot of online poker?
Yeah, I was playing online, a little bit of cash and quite a lot of sit and goes at the time and multiplayer tournaments. In fact, that was the reason I was in Vegas for that World Series tournament. I won because I won a frequent player point free roll tournament, which gave me a seat in the $25,000 entry five diamond tournament. And so I won that was a PokerStars seat that I won, the package. So I turned up in Vegas. I'd been there a few times before for backgammon, but never for poker, never for a poker tournament. And I played really awfully. I think I was on Doyle's table on the first round, and I think by level three I'd lost. I think the blinds were 25-50, and I managed to raise to 5,000, throwing in the wrong chip, and some smart guy saw it was a mistake in an on angle shoot and re-raised me. So I was playing that badly first big tournament and got knocked out in a few hours. And then I was going home the next week, but someone said, the World Series is starting tomorrow, why don't you play? You know, the first event, it was $2,000. So I said, why not, before I go home? And I didn't even know the World Series was on, or I didn't even know that you won a bracelet for most of those tournaments. I thought only the main event had a bracelet with it. I managed to win it, you know, 48 hours later. So it was just a miracle, really, or a sequence of events. And it was off the back of that, really, that I got into finance, because the day after I won it, a friend of mine was playing poker back in London at the Victoria Casino, phoned me up on the mobile phone to congratulate me. We were having a chat, and one of the recreational players of the Victoria said, who is that guy? When they told him about me, and I was only 23 and just won this tournament. And he said, I'm in finance, I'm a big trader, I'd like to meet him when he comes back. So when I came back, I did my research. It turns out he worked for Moore Capital, which was one of the most famous hedge funds in the world, biggest. And I went for lunch with him, and all he wanted to do was talk about poker and risk reward and all the stories, because he was an enthusiast. And basically introduced me to his boss, Lewis Bacon, who's one of the all-time great traders, and we got on quite well. And off the back of that, I got a job at Goldman Sachs and ended up working for him 6 years later. So it was a nice parlay.
So maybe I have the wrong impression, but I thought kind of working for these hedge funds was a lot about having computer programming skills and math skills, as opposed to the old days when people actually went down to a trading floor and traded. But was that what you were doing, or do I have
no? I've never used computers. To be honest, I can't even use a spreadsheet. I'm sort of, I guess, a more old school trader. There is a lot of quantitative trading, and now probably AI is evolving and changing trading. But there's still, in the end of the day, a lot of room for discretionary decisions, and a lot of money is basically managed by people who see the market going in a certain way and invest accordingly. So I ended up working for discretionary macro hedge funds, more capital, and then Graham Capital. And both of those roles over that period, a decade trading that kind of style, was really just having a view and reading all the news and watching the price action and using intuition and trying to solve the puzzle just better than average, I guess.
And did you focus on a particular area?
No, it was quite unusual in that I traded lots of different things, from equities, currency, fixed income, commodities. I pretty much traded everything. I was very lucky that I had bosses who just said, if you feel like you have an edge or feeling about something, go for it. Whereas most people just focus on one particular area, but I guess I probably even traded soybeans at some point in my career, to single name stocks, Turkish lira against the South African rand, all sorts of different, products.
But really, there's
humans behind decisions. And I think a lot of the patterns, probably a bit similar to backgammon, come up time and time again. And you can use charts and sort of feel price action and people behind it. And there's some part of it's fundamentals based upon what's going on in the world, and other parts of it are technical. But it's actually very similar to a lot of the gambling games, other than most gambling games are pretty binary. You make one decision on each betting street in poker or backgammon, the choice of three plays, but it's pretty much always the same game. You know, similar with blackjack or pretty much anything, whereas the market's evolving and so deep and there are no rules, and that the game changes every day. There's new things going on in the world, new products. So a style that would work in one market wouldn't work in another at a different period of time.
And did they keep track of your percentage gain for the year?
Oh, sure. I mean, every day we're mark to market, so you can tell how you're doing in percent on the year.
So, right. So how did you do compared to, say, the S&P 500, you know, over the years?
Well, that's a good question. I think at the start of my career, I massively outperformed, mostly because I was a pretty big bear during 2008, 2007, 2008 financial crisis. Well, obviously the S&P went down and I was short a lot of stuff and made a lot of money. In recent years, I massively underperformed the S&P, mainly because unless you were outright long stocks, there are no other trades that, gave you that kind of percentage return. And I was a macro trader, and investing in a macro fund, the idea wasn't just you get given an amount of capital and you invest by being long only, whether it's stocks or bonds, but you tried to find alpha, so edge hard to outperform.
I'm sorry, that Bob, did that all cut out for you as well?
Well, I heard it all.
Oh, okay.
And I thought it was fine. And I can't help but, you know, he keeps mentioning his gambling background helping him. And I'm thinking from the video poker point of view, where if the computer program tells me that I should hold something else, but I have a feeling that a royal flush is coming, so to make another play, and when that happens, I go lie down until the feeling goes away. And for me, it's all about mimicking the computer. So doesn't sound like I would do well in that world that you were in.
But well, I think the most interesting, also the most difficult part about trading is that there is no computer program that tells you the right answer. When you play backgammon these days, when you make a move afterwards, you can just run it through the computer and it'll tell you whether it was the right play or not. And it's pretty much happening in poker now with the algorithms and AI they're using, game theory trees. But on probably blackjack, you can tell what the count is and whether it's the right play or not to hit or not. But in the markets, something can happen. And even after the case, after the fact, you can look back and you still don't know whether it was the right thing, what the reason was, or whether it was just randomness. So it's a much more frustrating game in a way. You're never quite sure what your edge is.
Well, that's why I was asking about the keeping of records, because I mean, it can take a long time to figure out if you even have an edge, right? I mean,
absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, it's a scary thing, but obviously your bosses had faith in you, you know, to give you that leeway and let you trade. So
yeah, I guess after a certain period, a track record is all you've got, really. Right. And sometimes it's quite hard to explain.
Same thing
where your edge is,
betting,
but
right? If you bet sports, I mean, all you can really do is look at your records after a large enough data set. But so you eventually left trading, though, right? Why is that?
Well, only a few months ago. For a number of reasons. Probably I've been doing it for 14 years. I was feeling a little bit tired from it, needed a break. I mean, it might be something I go back to. I happen to have a tendency to prefer trading bear markets. So I think, you know, I'd probably be quite patient and wait for the next bear market before I look to trade again. And I felt like a new challenge rather than, you know, I'd spent 14 years looking at a Bloomberg terminal for, or eight screens in front of me for 14 hours a day, probably. And I've got two young kids and felt like trying something new.
And I assume you made quite enough money that you can afford to not trade anymore.
Yeah, I've done okay. Done okay.
Have a lot of gambling decisions, when to quit, when to go, those type of things, are sometimes there's women involved in that decision. Were there any wives or girlfriends, hopefully not both at the same time, who affected your decision to change games or change careers or anything like that?
Yeah, well, I had a very serious relationship. I was engaged actually to this girl when I was about 25 and a professional gambler. And her father was quite a religious Jew. I'm not religious, I'm pretty secular. But he didn't think gambling was a right way of life. And apart from the late nights and traveling, it sort of didn't, you know, he wasn't proud of it, basically, and wanted her daughter to marry someone a bit more establishment sort of type. And he basically told me, you know, it's the poker or my daughter. And, you know, I was enjoying poker at the time. I just won a World Series. I was pretty young and, it was a lot of fun. I was doing pretty well. And there was still, you know, clear edge, especially online at the time. But just around that time, someone wrote an article about me in the Daily Mail, a British tabloid newspaper, saying, I just won this World Series tournament. What do you want to do the rest of your life? And I don't know why, but I said, I want to be a trader, because I think someone had given me the Market Wizards book and it sounded like fun and you could gamble, you know, pretty high stakes and it was a legitimate job. And a friend of mine was working at Goldman Sachs and showed his boss this article, and the boss said, come in for an interview. So I went into Goldman Sachs, didn't really know what a bond was or anything like that. But we just sort of went to the pub, and all he wanted to do was talk about poker and gambling, and he happened to own some racehorses and, you know, in his spare time. And we got on really well, and I sort of got my introduction to the city like that. And I think I viewed it at the time like, if I don't take this spot, this chance now, it won't be there, but poker will always be there. Whereas if I kept playing poker for another 5-10 years, I'd be too old to get into finance, you know, at 35 or 40. So I was actually partly wrong on that, because poker really isn't there anymore. The game's changed so much, and the age is gone, but that was the reason. Apart from, you know, being so in love with this fiancé at the time, why I took that first job.
Is that who ended up your wife?
No, she didn't. So I guess I should be thankful for her, for her and her family getting me into trading. But we split up.
There's a lot in common between trading and gambling. The looking at a stock market as a big casino, there's a lot of merit to that analogy. So it's curious why being a trader would be considered that much different than being a gambler.
Yeah, I think quite a long time ago, you know, Susquehanna were a big options broking house, and they hired a lot of games players because they thought there were a lot of similarities. What I found is it's not, in my experience, it's not really a question of gambling with edge that's similar between the games and trading, but more the psychological impact of having swings, ups and downs, and being a really long run game and a bit of a grind, a bit like a cash game. You know, there's always another game, another day, every year's a long time, and you've got 365 days for gambling, and I think it's 255 or something like that days of trading a year. It feels like a long time. And when you do that for year after year, it's a sort of psychological battle, you know, which is much, the read across for me is much, much clearer than anything else.
All right. We're going to take a brief break, talk about our sponsors. And our first question when we come back is, does James prefer gamblers or traders, and why? The South Point has more than 10,000 games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In December, between now and the 24th, everything is half price when you use your points. This will include rooms, meals, New Year's Eve tickets, bowling, movies, etc. The points do not have to be earned in December, although if you do, that's fine too. This is a normal December promotion for the South Point, only it's hyphenated this year because the NFR rodeo was pushed back for a while. Christmas Day will be double points. All video poker machines from midnight to midnight, no limits. The free video poker classes will be on Tuesdays beginning January 9th. The schedule may be found on bobdancer.com. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. Quick Quads is a frequent game on for the game of the week. The reason I'm mentioning that is in the schedule of classes, we're doing a new Quick Quads version, which is Quick Quads with wheel poker simultaneously. Every time you spin the wheel, every time you get a quad or quick quad, you get to spin the wheel. This makes the game worth 99.8%, which is much higher than average. With the slot club of 0.3, you have a small advantage at all times. If you include the double point days and mailers, it's a more significant advantage. The game will be found for quarter triple play, which is going to be 525 a hand, or quarter five play, which is going to be 875 a hand. If these stakes are within your comfort zone, it's a very interesting game to look at. You may want to check out the class. All right, we're back talking to James Fogle. Now, you know a lot of gamblers. You know a lot of financial market traders and other financial market people. Who do you like for your friends and why?
Oh, that's a tough question. Well, it's not a tough question, but I've got a lot more friends who I consider true friends from the gambling world than I probably do from trading, which are, I'd say, a handful of true friends from trading. Whereas I think when I got into the gambling, I was much younger and all the young guys sort of stuck together and we were traveling to tournaments all over the world and you sort of stick together and hang out. And, you know, at the time when you don't have much money, you're sharing rooms, playing at tournaments, you know, sleeping in the same room, like three, four of you. And you develop this lifelong bond. And even though I haven't really professionally gambled for, at least a decade, I'm still in touch with most of them and hang out when I can. Whereas the traders, are probably much straighter and after long trading days, they go home to their families. So it's a little bit of a different atmosphere.
Do the traders look at themselves as gamblers?
No, definitely not. No. I mean, when I got into trading, I'd read like the book Liar's Poker and heard about all those stories where, you know, people were playing Liar's Poker for, you know, John Merriweather, or, you know, 100,000 or whatever. I honestly, I don't think I hardly ever saw a bet on a trading floor in 15 years. I think one time I had a press up bet where I had to, they bet I couldn't do 50 press ups in a minute and I took the over and I think I did 69, you know, for £100 a press up. So I was owed 1900 and I don't even think I got paid. Yeah, I think probably because most traders are gambling with other people's money or investors' money or the bank's money. Why would they gamble with their own money? They don't need to. They're on a free roll. So I think that was the biggest difference in mentality.
It's very different in the States. And in the exchanges in the States, there was a lot of backgammon, a lot of poker, a lot of just gambling in general. But part of that, I think, as you mentioned, Susquehanna and some of the other firms too, when I was hanging out in the backgammon club, there were a lot of traders who, this was in Chicago, you know, from the CBOE, and they would recruit players from the bridge and backgammon clubs because they, you know, thought there were a lot of very similar skills. But there was a lot of gambling on the trading floor back then.
But all those floors have gone now, and it's electronic. I think when they're on the most, from what I understand, most people on the floor were trading their own money. You had to put up your money to have a stake, and trade. Whereas all those jobs have gone, and they're all, it's all electronic, or the market making that there is for the vast majority of financial products is done from banks now, or brokers. So it's changed. I think the whole scene has changed. I think I probably would have had a lot more fun if I was trading in the 80s.
That'd be a lot of fun for a 6-year-old kid to be out there.
In the 70s, so my grandfather, that would have been fun before the computers back in the day.
Now, is a press up the same as a push up?
yeah, same thing.
The reason I'm asking is a couple years ago we had a guest on named Mark Billings, and in his book he had an interesting bet that he could do, he would bet a real large amount of money that he could do between 400 and 500 push-ups. And he got a lot of people to say no, that he couldn't. And so he ended up doing 7, which is more than 400 and less than 500. and he collected. I don't know how that would work in London, but it seemed to work well for him.
Reminds me of a story, not that I go there anymore, but outside a strip club in Vegas when I was much younger.
Places you've heard about. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, place I heard about.
Read a book once, yeah?
So, yeah, I was outside in the line with a guy who's quite a famous poker player now. I won't mention his name. And he said, I'll bet you for the entrance and the first drink on the toss of a coin. So I said, fine. So he flipped the coin, I won, and he said, okay, I'm paying for the entrance, now we're going to flip for the first drink. So was it, I'm betting you for the entrance and the drink, or I'm going to bet you for the entrance and I'm going to bet you for the drink?
I see. Yeah.
So, good
man. No, I think it's a shot.
Nice little shot, yeah.
And I think I can understand why you're not going to put him in public. Actually, you might want to out him in public so other people are aware of him.
Yeah, if Phil Lack did something like that to me, I would definitely, you know.
How did you know Phil was a friend of mine?
Well, you said you knew a lot of the Scandinavians, and he was very active in the backgammon world around the same time as Gus, and moved over to
It's funny, I was in LA a month ago and stayed at his place with him and Jen in Beverly Hills, and it was good fun to catch up.
Yeah,
although every other sentence
for quite a while to try to get him to come on the show, and for a guy who likes as much publicity as he does, I don't understand why he's been dodging.
He likes the sound of his own voice. I'll give him a call later and tell him to come on the show.
Please do.
Yeah,
there you go. Okay.
And tell him he can wear his Unabomber sweatshirt on the air too if he wants.
Okay. Yeah.
Now you played lots of different games. Chess, backgammon, gin, poker, bridge, I don't know if any others. How have you found them different? How have you found the skills the same?
Clearly there's a big overlap, but I think, you know, if someone's good at one game, they should be able to pick up the others. I think somehow the mindset and the way of thinking in backgammon and poker is very similar. Probably gin rummy as well. Bridge I've had the biggest difficulty with. It might be because I started late. I didn't start till I was about 26. But it's funny because I really enjoy it the most of all the games, but I really suck. But somehow my mind just can't function that way. It's like I'm not very good at reading maps, and you have to just be able to visualize a lot more in bridge, a little bit like reading a map and sort of remember patterns, as well as the partnership aspects, I guess. So I'd say the biggest difference is probably bridge to the others. You know, whereas most chess players can pretty much play poker or backgammon to some level.
Well, about going on tilt? Or was that a problem for you?
No, it was never really a problem for me. I guess with a backgammon, it's pretty hard to go on tilt in backgammon because you always know what the right move is and wrong move. Whereas what's that?
I said, have you ever met Paul McGrill?
Yeah, sure, I know Paul.
People go hard and they start taking doubles that they know they shouldn't take.
It's very rare in backgammon for that to happen. Whereas when you're playing poker and you're not quite sure what the right play is, it's very easy to justify a bad play in your mind and just end up gambling. So I would say steaming wasn't really my problem. Probably more the reverse. I'd probably lock up and tighten up a bit too much when things weren't going right, or quit a bit too early where I could have taken more risk or stayed in the game and gambled a bit more when I was down if it was a good game. So I probably had the reverse problem of tilt, which is also a problem. I guess it's tilting in another way, becoming too tight and not taking the opportunities.
One of the things that I notice about poker players that I found bizarre compared to other forms of gambling is a lot of professional poker players seem to have really big leaks where they will gamble at things where they know they don't have an edge, like craps or sports betting, where in a lot of other forms of professional gambling, you know, a card counter just, they would never consider doing those kind of things because they understand their edge and they just don't want to gamble without an edge. What's your experience with that? I mean, did you have any of these kind of leaks or?
I think everyone has leaks. For some people it might be sports betting, for other people it might be having difficulties communicating with people in the normal world because you're so wrapped up in gambling, and it could be a sort of a leak that affects your real life. There's so many different types. I guess it's being self-aware enough to understand that you have a leak, which probably helps. So if you take ego out of it, you're less liable. But everyone has, well, most people have their sicknesses in one way or another. I guess maybe some of the top players, you know, they reach the top, and the games aren't big enough to excite them anymore, or they've been crushing for so long that they need an outlet just to release that, really, I'd probably say. Because in the end of the day, whatever game you're playing, if you play it for 50 to 100 hours a week, like a lot of gamblers do, eventually, you know, you get bored. So how do you deal with that boredom? And maybe that's one of the reasons.
Yeah, one of the things Chip Reese said to me when I interviewed him was that it seemed so easy to make the money that it didn't really matter to him because, you know, he could just always go out and make more.
That's like the drug dealers whenever money comes too easy, you just go out and spend it like it's not real money. Maybe that's a reason.
Do you see yourself returning to the gambling world?
I think I'll always be a gambler. You know, I love playing games, and above all, I love the people. I guess looking back at it, all the characters I met and hung out with and got to play with, on and off the table, I guess, hanging out with. So it will always be a hobby. I don't think I'll ever become a professional gambler again. And I guess the new venture I'm trying to start with Cerebral Gym, which I might sort of try and plug a little bit, is finding a way, to create something where an environment where I can enjoy and take a lot of the things that I used to enjoy about gambling, but without gambling, if that makes sense.
Well, give us some for instances.
Well, it would be nice. I like to learn new things. So if I could go to a club in an environment where, like the way I learned backgammon or poker or trading. If I could go to an environment which is like a fun place to go to and learn how to speak Chinese or learn something about opera appreciation and hang out with other people that want to learn that too, that, you know, that could be a lot of fun. So, you know, my idea basically is to try and start a chain of gyms, but instead of working out your body, you go to work out your mind. And what I really want to do is create a club, if truth be told, that I'd want to go to. Because I don't really enjoy going to the gym too much.
So these are a type of school. It's different.
I wouldn't really call it a school.
If I were going to study Chinese, I would think I was going to do that in the school or online or something.
Yeah, but the thing is, I don't really want. I think that's what I'm trying to make a solution to. In that, I don't want to go to a night school and learn Chinese. I want to go to more of a nightclub and hang out with other like-minded people or in the same socioeconomic bracket and people that are same sort of demographic and age group. In a fun environment, drink some good wine, listen to some good music, and learn Chinese. But if you don't want to learn Chinese, there'll be a games room, so you could come play bridge or backgammon, or I don't think there'll be poker, because there's not really going to be any gambling, but so, we're going to have a games room and a bar, and a screening room for arty-type movies, book clubs, all sorts of things which are fun to do, but you don't have to take too seriously. So you might just dip in and out, and wouldn't expect someone to come and learn Mandarin and be fluent in it, but you might understand a bit more about what the language is and, you know, how the characters are formed in a few sentences and just sort of dip in and dip out of it.
So you're talking about actual brick and mortar locations. When you first mentioned this, I was just assuming that it was going to be something online.
Yeah, brick and mortar locations. I mean, it will be linked to online because I figure if I can get the best teachers in these places and pay a lot of money for these teachers for the live classes, I can film these classes and then transmit them online as well via the website or some kind of, I call it cerebral social network online, where people can share problems they have in learning and discuss it online as well, or in a sort of app form. So I think it's going to be live and online and integrate the two.
To me, that sounds really cool, and I would sign up on day one if you open one in Las Vegas.
Well, you know, go on the website, www.cerebralgym.com, put your email in, and I'll keep you up to date when we launch in Vegas. I kind of like to open in Vegas, too, so I can spend more time there. It's a good excuse.
Well, also, I think Vegas would be a great location for something like that, too.
It could be. Do you think there's the sort of intellectual drive and passion there in Vegas? I was sort of thinking more in terms of the States, probably start in New York, possibly San Francisco.
You have a pool of people in New York, but I definitely think that there is an audience for exactly that here in Vegas. Absolutely.
Hmm. Well, maybe you could start the first franchise in Vegas for me.
Well, that sounds like that? Work. It sounds like working for a living, but I'd love to be a customer.
Okay. Well, I hope it comes true.
Yeah, I hope so too. I would think in a university community would be more of the type of places where there's a lot of stimulation going on. Well, maybe, you know, a city like Boston, where they have 50 universities or some such within a few miles of the Boston Commons. But I don't see Las Vegas as a intellectual hotbed. I belong to a couple of gambling groups. Richard's in one of them. And, you know, we're, you know, exploring areas of gambling, and that is intellectual, and we're exploring new things. But as a general, I mean, we do have a Smith Center, which is our opera house, so to speak. And
there's still art galleries in some of the casinos, right?
There are a lot of art galleries outside the casinos, too. And,
there are
places like the Center for Science and Wonder that are interested in intellectual pursuits. And, you know, I mean, again, we're, you know, a city of or an area of a million, as opposed to New York or London or whatever. Are you thinking about opening the first one in London?
Yeah, the first one's going to open in London probably next September. I'm working on sort of gathering the content, and I'm just in the process of signing a lease that I found in central London. So hopefully by the time I do the place up, it will be ready just after the summer. Yeah. It's interesting what you said about the students, because I was thinking when you're at university or college, you call it, you know, already there's a lot of intellectual input, and you might not want that sort of extra diverse sort of way of learning. Whereas, you know, for the age group of, say, 25 to 45, you finish college, but that doesn't mean you have to stop learning. And I think a lot of people probably miss the collegial atmosphere and would like somewhere where they can go and hang out just like they did when they were at college and learn, but in a fun environment.
When I was a kid, there was a place in Chicago called the College of Complexes, and they basically used to meet in the back room of a bar, and they would have speakers and symposiums about all kinds of different topics, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think I definitely think there's...
I think that's exactly the thing I found in London, and when I spent time, quite a bit of time in New York, is that there's a lot of intellectual activities and speakers and lectures and courses going on, but it's really fragmented and they're in lots of different areas, and you have to travel there and there and there, you know, ABC all over the city each different night.
Right.
Whereas I was thinking, if you have one permanent location, or say four in one city, where there's always activity going on, you could develop more of an atmosphere of a club where people know each other, and there's alcohol that helps. Yeah, exactly.
And in Las Vegas, there could be marijuana as well.
Well, yeah, okay.
That could work.
So you can smoke marijuana in public in Vegas now?
Not in public yet.
Hmm.
Yeah.
But
it is legal, and recreational is legal.
I actually went to a stand-up comedy show last night because I was trying to recruit the guy who's the comedian to come and do a show at the launch party for this Cerebral Gym idea. And I haven't got his delivery, but he said one joke about, I think he was joking about Prince Harry used to smoke a lot of marijuana, and he got sent to marijuana rehab. And he goes, "Where I'm from, there is no marijuana rehab. You just go to sleep, and you wake up, and you know, everything's fine."
When you were gambling or trading, was cheating ever an issue in your experience?
In gambling, I don't think I was cheated very many times, although, you know, maybe I was, and I didn't realize it. I definitely didn't get paid a lot of the time, back in the days of backgammon especially. So I guess that's a form of cheating. But it's pretty hard to cheat in backgammon. I mean, the only thing I can really think of is loaded dice or mismoving the pieces, but those kind of guys get found out pretty quickly, and no one wants to play with them. I did get cheated in a London casino in poker once, which was quite an interesting story. I went along, there was quite a big game. I lost, I think it was about a £20,000 pot against this Russian guy. And it just didn't feel right. I can't really explain it. But the way the betting went down on each street just didn't feel right. And after the game, I went away, and I actually, I was on the phone to Mike Subodny, I'm sure you know him.
Yes.
All-time great gamblers, the next day, and I sort of mentioned, there was this Russian guy in the game, and I lost his pot, and it didn't feel right, and he goes, "Oh, it must be X." And I said, "Yeah, how did you know?" And he said, "Oh, he's a well-known, cheat." So I went back to the guy who was running the game, and they looked on the cameras, and sure enough, he was, holding cards back and just old-fashioned up the sleeve and bringing them out, you know, on the river when he needed it to make a set. So yeah, I was cheated in that one, although the casino never paid me back. It was quite infuriating, really. But they paid other people that lost in the game, but not me.
How do they pay other people but not you? How does that work?
Well, he was a really weak player. He was winning all these pots on the river. And I think he won about $250,000 in the month that he was playing in this London casino. It was the Palm Beach on Berkeley Street in central London. And he had $250,000 on deposit when I told them about it and they checked the cameras and caught him. So they held that money back and called the police. Now, basically the police got involved and the whole thing had to go through the judicial process and, they put an arrest warrant out for this guy. But of course he went back to Russia and never came back. And then basically they couldn't distribute the $250,000 until he was tried. Or they had to, wait 6 or 7 years statutory period or something. It just dragged on and on and on. And I think eventually the casino decided to pay out, its regular customers that were there every day playing. And they got paid back. I think half of it probably went in legal fees and another 100, 150 got distributed to some of their regular players. And they decided not to pay me back. But I didn't think it was worth pursuing, really. Just wrote it off. Just one of those things in gambling.
Yes, or having somebody take a shot when you're in line at the strip club. I hate it when that happens.
I mean, I would have been happy to pay for him for both, either way. So, it was a pretty cheap shot.
Ah, so if he's listening to this show, he might learn to shoot bigger next time when you're around.
Well, don't give him ideas.
All right, this has been fun. We've been talking to James Vogel, game player, trader, and has a new concept called the Cerebral Gym. When it gets going, we want to hear about it. Thank you, James, very much for gracing our podcast today.
Well, thank you guys for having me. It was good fun.
Thank you, Richard. Go out and hit a royal flush, everybody. Good day.